Well, toll roads, congestion charging, rail versus bus transport, all are being grappled with by central and local government as the answer to urban congestion. So what are the best long-term strategies to deal with traffic issues and encourage public transport use? And are private infrastructure partnerships the solution? David Hensher is the founding director of the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies and professor of management at the University of Sydney. It's had its own traffic issues. He's regarded as an international authority on urban transport and the role of private partners in infrastructure developments. He's in New Zealand this week to help launch a new business institute at Waikato University. Professor Hensher joins us now on the line from Hamilton. Good morning. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Catherine. Pleasure to be here.
So what is the best strategy for tackling traffic management? Does it come down to a couple of big projects that make all the difference? Or is it far more complex than that?
I wish it was so easy. It's far more complex. And I think I often have a phrase I make that to make public transport more attractive, you've got to make the car less attractive. And despite all the efforts to discourage people to use their cars in situations where we've got horrendous congestion, at the end of the day, there's really only one instrument that's actually going to make a difference as far as we can see, and that's to change the pricing. This does mean that we've not only got to think about how we charge for the amount of congestion, but we've also got to really review the whole cost of owning and using a car. And there's some quite radical propositions around the world that I think Australia and New Zealand are starting to understand, but the politics are such that they're not willing to take the big jump and make the changes because pricing is often very low on their agenda because of the political backlash.
So on the old carrot and stick argument, you're saying it has to be stick in the first instance to change behaviour.
It does indeed. If I use Holland and a couple of other places in the world as good examples of what they're doing at the moment, is they're arguing that, you know, we've got to move away from this traditional registration charge arrangement per year, which is an ownership charge, and then and have fairly low costs of using the car, mainly the fuel, and to recognise that people are often getting the benefits of road investment but not actually paying fully for it. I mean, time's actually money, and even though some politicians think that roads are free, in fact they're not free because the cost of lost time is horrendous to individuals and industry. So we've got to rethink about the usage of the car. And what they're doing around in a number of countries, now we've got all this fancy GPS technology, we can actually monitor exactly where cars travelling time of day and what sort of car it is in terms of emissions, and come up with a rule that says you pay so much per kilometre, it's called a distance-based charge, according to the amount of congestion you're in and, of course, the emissions of the car. And then, of course, if you're travelling in situations where you're on roads with no congestion, you've got a fairly gas-guzzling free car, you'll pay far less than you would today in terms of the equivalent of the vehicle registration. That's been shown. So we've got to change our state of mind, but we mustn't keep saying, as the media says, as soon as you talk about a congestion charge, they immediately call it a tax and they call it an add-on to the existing costs. We've got to actually rethink that and talk about restructuring the entire pricing formula so that those who get the benefit pay, and that'll deliver revenue as well that has to be earmarked to some extent back to public transport.
If it's not a tax, what would you call it? A direct...
Well, it's a less emotive term like a charge or a price. Now, you might say, well, that is a tax. Okay, fair enough. You want to call it a tax. What we're saying is we've got to rethink how much people pay in terms of usage costs, and that includes fuel excise, given the benefit they get from using the road network and the contribution they make by their presence and adding to congestion. Do you know, compared with electricity, compared with water, the road area is so poorly priced in terms of the benefits and the costs that people get.
Well, you're talking essentially about a direct emissions charge, aren't you? Especially if you can measure what the individual is emitting.
Well, yes, and you can. It's easy these days with GPS technology and our onboard computer monitoring. You can actually not only measure it, but you can also report it back to a charging mechanism to be actually just like a toll in Australia where you have an electronic tag. It can come straight out of your bank account without you even having to worry about it, getting a bill if that's the way you want to do it. And it works so efficiently in Australia now with electronic tolling that people just accept it as the way of life. Absolutely right. Whether you want to call it a carbon tax or something else, it is an emission charge for polluting the environment.
Yeah, but it's personalised to the vehicle. So if you're getting around in a great big SUV, you're going to be paying more than someone who's got a hybrid.
Absolutely. It's got to be related to the damage you do. It's not fair. The current system is tremendously unfair. We've got this fuel excise, which is not very, very highly correlated with this. We've got these ownership charges, which are also not highly correlated with use. So when people say to me this new system is not fair, well, I tell you, the current system is even less fair.
I suppose we do share costs, though, as we do indeed for the roads themselves. And one example might be heavy users like commercial trucks. Their cost must, if you went to this personalised, individualised system, would go through the roof, wouldn't they?
Well, I think there's a bit of equity here. You've got to structure it in such a way that the industry's got to remain viable. You just, it's certainly true there's a risk here, but, you know, this is, New Zealand actually leads the way with mass weight type taxes for heavy vehicles, and Australia's trying to catch up. But I think you've got to be sensible about this. None of this is designed to kill off the sector. At the same time, we've got to say, OK, fair's fair. If you're actually causing more damage, you should contribute proportionally.
What about the carrot bit then? What are the alternatives? And surely they've got to be cost-effective public transport alternatives, and we seem to argue till we get ourselves spun in a circle in this country about what they might be. Let's look at the Auckland context. As far as you can see about the state it's in now, what would be your recommendations for some major infrastructural projects that might make a difference there?
It's a good point. First of all, I want to say that we have to see Auckland as a major metropolitan area, not just a CBD. And I think you have to recognise that increasingly a lot of the traffic is circumferential. It's not going into the CBD. And that you've then got the big challenge about how best to serve the whole metropolitan area. And just like Australian cities, where we seem to have this CBD-centric focus, let's have one or two big rail projects around the centre, which in principle I'm not opposed to. But the question is, though, how much money then we've got left over to do other things? And what tends to be happening is that as you invest more in heavy rail to serve the centre, you're neglecting the amount of commitment that's needed to serve the rest of the metropolitan area. And although some will tell me, OK, we're putting more buses on the roads, but they're still mixing with the cars, and as the traffic builds up, we have a problem there with unreliable public transport. So one thing that's happening around the world is looking for an alternative that actually can deliver dedicated road-based public transport, which is actually going to cost far less than railways, because we just can't afford to invest in the heavy rail and even to some extent light rail to the extent that we would need to try and solve the problems for the whole metropolitan area. So we're talking now about what's known as bus rapid transit. You've got one to some extent on the North Shore. You've got that 8 kilometres of busway, as it's called, which is a good idea. But the question is, though, it's not well connected to the rest of the system. And I think we've got to ask ourselves seriously, having committed all this money to this heavy rail extension in the city, could we have actually spent that money better on far more kilometres of bus rapid transit, which is dedicated roads to dedicated buses like Brisbane, which are about, depending on whether you have to tunnel or not, can be something like 20 to 50 times less expensive per kilometre.
So in your view, basically, buses will trump trains simply on a cost basis when it comes to the urban networks.
Absolutely, and also they've got the good capacity as well. I mean, often people say, well, they can't carry as many people, this is rubbish, because we're not interested in vehicle capacity, we're interested in service capacity, which is capacity per hour, and you can deliver 20, 30, 40,000 passengers per hour on a good bus system on dedicated roads with articulated buses. And the question I always put back to listeners is, well, how many people are being carried per hour on the rail system at the moment in Auckland? Is it 20,000 now? I doubt it. So the question is, why are we putting so much heavy investment into those systems to carry numbers that could be carried by far more cost-effective systems?
I was going to ask you, how do you know, which seems a facetious question, but it's not really, because I'm sure there's some very complicated number crunching that goes into this, and this is the sort of figure that you're talking about, number of bodies moved per distance per hour.
Absolutely, that's a good measure. Often people say, well, the mode must deliver a certain amount of capacity per hour, that's service capacity or passengers, bums on seats. Absolutely.
You talk about OD connectivity, which I think might mean origin to destination, and actually we could simplify it from getting from A to B. And is that where a lot of systems fall down? They don't actually work out where someone is trying to get from and two in the greatest numbers.
Catherine, you've hit the nail on the head. That's precisely right. You begin your trip from your home to your workplace or your shops or whatever, and often when we're planning here, we focus so much on the big project, which is the railway. And, you know, some railway people think the trip begins and ends at the railway station. I say, no, and sadly it doesn't. You've got to get to and from. And so one of the things we're finding increasingly now is that the crucial issue is that the public transport stops as close to your destination as possible so you can walk, because at least you could drive your car to the bus station or the rail station at the origin where you begin your trip, i.e. at home. And so you're absolutely right. And this is the whole issue of the challenge about getting good coverage. It must be door-to-door. That's the real test. And if you have trouble getting to the bus or the railway, you're not going to use it. You're going to continue to drive.
What about speed? Is this where the dedicated lanes are critical?
Absolutely critical. It's also frequency. I mean, my magic words are frequency, connectivity, and visibility. Visibility, especially for buses, so you know where they're going, which is an advantage of trains, of course. It's better.
What would you do in Auckland? Would you double? Would you treble the number of buses? What would it
need?
Yes,
I've made a point in Sydney, and I've got a lot of people are interested, but you know, you talk to the government, and they say, what a great idea. Let's double the buses and see what happens, because if it fails, you pull it out. If you build a railway and it fails, it's too late. You've sunk your money. The bus operators say, what a great idea, but as long as the government pays. So why not do some trials, especially during school holidays when there's a bit of spare bus capacity? Double the frequency and see what happens. And when you talk to the people in Brisbane, where their frequency is absolutely unbelievable, 5 to 10 minutes in the peak at least, and then half an hour in the off-peak, you find that it's the frequency that's attracting people out of their cars. But it's also the connectivity, the fact that you can get good feeder access to the main bus rapid transit means that you've got a really efficient minimum interchange trip from your home to your workplace. Brisbane is such a classic example. In fact, it's almost become a heritage system, and people travel all over the world to look at it because they've decided to go bus rapid transit, even though for political reasons they're going to stick a bit of LRT in soon, but that's
light rail. Yeah,
light rail. Bus rapid transit is what they've gone for, and they've got over 50 kilometres of it now, and they're just so smiley and happy about it because it's delivered something that they could never have afforded to deliver that amount of assets if they were going to go heavy rail. It just would have been far too expensive.
Which is where the mayors of both Auckland and Wellington are perhaps running projects that you would disagree with.
I would disagree with them. Wellington is so—it's small. It's so low dense. It's got a fairly widely spread origin destination. So surely a decent bus network where the traffic's bad, you dedicate to roads that are only on buses would be the way to go. And I had coffee with the shadow treasurer in New South Wales on Tuesday, and the Liberals are going to get in, we're pretty sure, in New South Wales next year. And one of the first things they're going to do is start developing a bus rapid transit system up the north shore.
What do those words mean? Because, you know, why don't we get on buses? And I'll tell you why I don't like getting on them often. They're slow, they're crowded, they're old, they're rickety. You know, if you get on the Euro rail in Europe, you're quite happy. You get on the equivalent public transport here, you're not.
The image of a bus is terrible. It's the, you know, there's a lot of emotional ideology in this stuff, and people often say buses are boring, trains are sexy, you know. And the trouble is, buses, as we know them, are in mixed traffic. They're often old. They use old technology, so they've got poor diesel pouring out of them, which is not good. And so we've got this major image problem, whereas bus rapid transit is, as it says, it's actually essentially, it looks like a train, it smells like a train, it operates like a train, it's on its own roads. So instead of having track, you've got roads, there's no overhead wires, and you've got these very modern articulated buses that can carry up to 120 people.
Which is going to cost, and that brings us to how you fund. And one of your real areas of study is the public-private partnerships. We know some have gone spectacularly wrong in your home country.
Yes.
What can we learn from that?
Well, I mean, let's say when they've gone wrong, the people that have benefited have been the public, the people that have lost have been the investors, of course. It's an interesting issue. Public private partnerships are really in the shadow now, because governments could actually raise money at a far more a better financial deal than actually the PPP. And I think the main reason why we've been going PPPs is because we want to keep our AAA and get money off the government balance sheet, so to speak. But it's actually, it could turn out that it's false economics, other than politicians using that as an argument that we'd never be able to build these things earlier if we had to fund them ourselves. In fact, I think that's a nonsense, because at the end of the day, the government's paying for this stuff anyway on a concession. But having said all that, to be honest, there's some very smart management skills in the private sector, and I personally think that there's no reason why we shouldn't in the future look to the government actually owning the infrastructure and financing it, and having the private sector running these things, because they'll run it far more efficiently. That's not the traditional PPP in the sense that all the risk is shared equally across the two. So I think we've got to rethink what we mean by a PPP, and I'm actually keener these days, I think, to have government raising the funds to actually build the jolly thing, even if they use construction companies, but to have the private sector operate these things, because they can do it much better.
On specific projects, the rail-to-airport idea, nowhere in the world does it pay its way, this model. Yes. And is that just the nature of this particular route, or is it the way it's delivered?
Well, I think it's the nature of the route. I think there is as many successful PPPs as there are negatives, and unfortunately, we hit on the negatives. In Sydney, it's the Cross City Tunnel, Lane Cove Tunnel, and the Airport Link. But you've got to look at the M7 and the M2 as major toll roads, and they're outstandingly successful. I might be monitoring their performance, and they're actually now at forecast levels of traffic and so on. And by the way, as an aside, I mean, to your listeners, whenever these things are built and opened, you've got to wait at least 2 years for the forecasts of traffic to settle down. I mean, the actual traffic to settle down before you should make a statement. Trouble with the media is, as soon as the thing's built, within a week, if the numbers are lower than the forecast, they say it's a dog. It's far too early.
Just on one other point then, back to the congestion charge. Sounds like some extensive equipment would be needed. It might be available, but would be needed to do the individualised charging that you're talking about.
Yep.
Should a city like Auckland and or Wellington, if the politicians were up for it, move to a more general congestion charge, first of all, perhaps a ring loop in the city?
Yep, it's certainly, the good thing is to get started, and although I think that it's not going to have the impact if it's just downtown compared with the whole metropolitan area, I think to put a cordon charge in, like a fixed charge to enter the central business district, since electronic tolling is a pretty standard technology these days on automobiles, buses, and you name it, then you link this back to a banking network, whether you've got a clearinghouse of a bank to collect the money and distribute it and what have you. Very easy to do. And I think in many ways, Australia is really ahead of the world, because we have that fully interoperable in all cities. To do that here, the technology is not the challenge. The challenge is the politics of wanting to do it. And I would say that even though I think the benefits will be relatively small to do it downtown, the fact that politicians will allow it to happen is a good stepping start. And then you can move it to the rest of the metropolitan area. So, for example, in Singapore, where I'm an advisor to the Minister of Transport, where you have road pricing in the downtown, we're seriously talking now about putting into the whole metropolitan area, because congestion is all over the place. You know, it's not one of those things. You can go into the suburbs of Auckland, and there's as much congestion at certain times of the day on the roads as there is in the city. So you've got to make it metropolitan-wide. But, boy, if you can get started with the city, because the politicians are willing to go with that, 100 out of 100.
If is the word. Thanks. Thanks for joining us. That is Professor David Hensher, Founding Director of the Institute of Transport and Logistics Studies and Professor of Management at the University of Sydney, an international authority on urban transport issues and policies. Here to help launch a new business institute at Waikato University.